Okay, rule nine, why does God allow, why does God remove the consolations and allow the enemy
to send desolations? As a means of healing us from our faults, and the goal is to convert us to Jesus. As a means of learning, he permits the trial. So for us to learn what in the world is going on, and then improve our behavior. And then, or our mindset. A lot of times it's just improving our mindset. As a means of letting us see that consolation is pure gift, and he desires that we grow in spiritual humility. We are not owed consolations. We see that everything comes from God. Without him, we are nothing. Okay, so that's what we covered last week. Yeah, I talked to him. Okay, classic. All right, we'll get through them. These rules are, this week we're doing rules 10 through 15. 10 through 14, I just made up an extra rule. 10 through 14. And they're a little, they change in tone. So rule 10 says, let him who is in consolation think how he will be in the desolation which comes after, taking new strength for then. So rule 10 is addressing consolation. Finally, you're like, okay, he set the stage in rules 1 through 4, and then in 5 to 9, he just depressed me constantly by talking about this desolation. I don't even want to talk about that anymore. When is he going to talk about the good stuff? When I read these for the first time, that's literally, I was like, oh my gosh, stop talking about the desolation. When are you going to talk about the gifts we get? Here you go, rule 10. So what this rule says is that when we're in consolation, he's still going to refer to desolation. What we should be doing is storing up the gifts for when we're in desolation. So he's still equipping you to deal with desolation. So when you're in desolation, Ignatius doesn't want you to be grumpy and like, oh, I can feel the desolation coming. No, it's what's going on now. So that, and I want to pay attention to it and write it down. I want to journal. I'm going to tell a friend. I'm going to remember so that when the desolation hits, I can refer to this and it'll help me move through the desolation faster. So this is like storing up the good stuff for when things are not so good, and then I can draw back on that. In AA, there's a great expression, and it's don't take an advance out on the pain. So we don't want to take, we don't want to, when in consolation, think about the desolation and then pull ourselves backwards. That wouldn't be a desolation from the devil. That would just be us being stupid and us thinking about the desolation in a negative way. But you want to be aware of what pulls you into, if there are things that you do to contribute to the desolation. Sometimes the devil just visits desolation on us and we didn't do anything to cause it. We can be, you know, hey, I'm going to 3 masses a week, I'm praying daily, I'm going to adoration, I'm doing everything kind of right. And then out of the blue, boom, I get hit with desolation, which is like bad mood, temptation, whatever that is. All of a sudden I feel not close to God. That just, the devil throws it at me. It's what I do with it that matters. So if I'm paying attention, like, oh, I see, that's a desolation, forget it, go away. I'm going to an extra hour of adoration, or I'm going to call my friend Nancy and we're going to talk about it and that'll help me through it. Or, hey, I'm going to call, well, I don't call Brad at work about that, it irritates him. When Brad gets home from work, I'll talk about this with him. Whatever it is opposed, the other thing, the opposite view would be, oh man, I've been doing everything so well. And then, and see, that's about me. I've been doing everything so well. So I'm being a really good Christian. And then the devil hits me with this stuff. And then I'm like, oh, I can't earn it. This sucks. I quit. Okay? So that's a pretty extreme differing opinion. But that's a different way that you would receive the desolation. Okay, back to rule 10. What this rule about is preparation. So when you're in consolation, prepare for the desolation. In the same way that a well-prepared fortress can withstand siege, a well-prepared soul can withstand attacks from the enemy. Planning is the key. But don't do this out of fear. This is out of an abundance of caution and out of a desire to stay close to God because we love him. So the fundamental purpose of the 14 rules remains constant. It's our great need is for assistance overcoming spiritual desolation. Because consolations are good, it's not like we need a lot of help with that, right? If you have a great prayer experience, you might want to share it with a friend, you might want to journal it, but you just accept it. There's nothing really to do there. So that's why he spends more time talking about desolation, because there is something to do when we're desolation, and that's what he's giving us as the tools to deal with that. So in Rule 10, Ignatius instructs us on how to prepare to deal with the desolation while we're in consolation. The other rules, 5-9, teach us how to deal with desolation when we're in desolation. So God gives spiritual consolation that through it our faith may deepen, our hearts will grow in love, and our whole being will expand in new spiritual life. Our primary task in consolation always remains to accept the blessed work of God within us through consolation. So when we're in consolation, think. Notice patterns. Journal. When you're in a good place, think back. Well, okay, when that last desolation happened, what was going on? What was I doing? What made me vulnerable? How did I react? How did I handle it? All that sort of thing. If we don't prepare, the desolation will surprise us and discourage us. But if we're ready, the next time the desolation comes, we can fight it back. It doesn't feel as hard. We will be ready to resist more quickly with the help of God's grace, which is always sufficient. God's grace is always sufficient, and God's grace is always with us. That's what gets us through the desolation. God's grace is always sufficient. Remember that. Where do we get sanctifying grace? Sanctifying grace comes from the sacraments. Where do we get actual grace? That comes from sacramentals, from prayer, from other spiritual things we do. That grace, God's grace is always sufficient to help us survive the situation. You can pray a prayer of petition for strength in future desolation. Consider the value of desolation for spiritual growth. So when you're in a good place, think, oh yeah, I learned so much when I was, that desolation was horrible to get through, I was miserable, but I learned so much, I'm actually okay with it. Reflecting on past personal growth. Resolve not to make any changes when the desolation, remember that from our previous rules. And then read the rules. When you're in consolation, read these 14 rules to remind yourself what they are. The more familiar you are with them, they begin to lose their numbers. I don't even, as I use it in my day, I'm not thinking about anything numbers-wise. I'm just noticing movements and using all these tools. The more you read it, the more it becomes a thing you can use and not just a list of rules. So familiarize yourself with this. Read the books. Listen to the podcast. Knowledge will help you here. Okay, so that is all of Rule 10. Prepare when you're in consolation. Does that make sense? Any questions on that one? Pretty straightforward. Rule number 11. We could subtitle this one, Finding Our Balance. So I'm going to read this one. These are Ignatius' words. Let him who is consoled see to humbling himself and lowering himself as much as he can, thinking how little he is able for in the time of desolation without such grace or consolation. On the contrary, let him who is in desolation think that he can do much with the grace sufficient to resist all his enemies, taking strength in his Creator and Lord. So what does this mean? When all the rules leading up to 11, Ignatius has talked about one state or another. So we're either in consolation or in desolation. In this rule, he brings the two together, and he's trying to teach us how to live in balance. He's showing us that you get both kinds of movements within the day. The more you pay attention to that, the more you will notice that. And he's teaching us how to not let either swing us so far in either direction that we're not sort of living in the middle. All the saints found that living in the middle of the road is much easier than living on either of the edges. So, yes, St. Teresa's ecstasy was a wonderful thing, but that's not where she spent most of her time. She spent most of her time teaching all her sisters, who were the nuns, inspiring them, just living the daily life with them. So sure, sometimes in prayer she had these amazing experiences, but that was not the norm of her life. So Ignatius is trying to teach us how to live a balanced life, because balanced means you've mastered your passions, using your will, and your intellect is available to you, and our intellect is where we communicate with God. So Ignatius is teaching us in this rule how to live there, how to live the balanced life. It's really my favorite of the rules because of that. He points out that it's important to have a humble heart when in consolation. That's what he's saying in that first sentence. In Rule 9, Ignatius's main point was to help us see that God permits desolation so that we learn to anchor ourselves in humility. And he reminds us when in consolation to seek to have a humble heart. Why? Why is he stressing humility? Just because he admires it? Because of course he does admire the virtue of humility. And humility is the basis. It's the hub. It's the hub of all the other virtues. They all spring from humility. And a humble heart is ripe for God's call and service. But Ignatius also is always, in the rules, he is always addressing discernment. So how does humility fit into discernment? Humility helps us see that everything comes from God. Right? That's what it really is all about. Because if everything comes from God, it really doesn't have anything to do with me. It has to do with him. So humility is about, think about Jesus. What did Jesus always, always, always do? This is all over the Gospel of John. He points to God, his Father. That's all he does. He never talks about Jesus. He talks about his Father. That's what he does. That's what we're supposed to do. So in seeing that everything comes from God, we're rooted in this humble state. When the consolations leave, we'll know that we didn't earn them, that they were just a gift. And we will know that it's God's will that they come and go, and we won't be rocked. We won't be chasing consolations. We won't be freaking out in fear that we're waiting for the desolations. We'll just be accepting God's divine providence, which is really what discernment of spirits is about, is learning to live in that place of balance, which is accepting God's divine providence in the present moment. We should not presume to trust our own energies in the spiritual life, but in everything lean on and trust in God, our Heavenly Father. So that's the first sentence. Let him who is consoled see to humbling himself and lowering himself as much as he can, thinking how little he is able for in the time of desolation without such grace or consolation. On the contrary, let him who is in desolation think that he can do much with the grace sufficient to resist his enemies. So in the same day, you've just had consolation, now you have desolation. It may be not a big deal, but know that God will give you the grace sufficient to work through it. So in this rule 11, he then explains that when in desolation, we ought to trust in the Lord and his divine providence. And if we think about what God is trying to teach us through allowing it, then with faith and courage, we can persevere and look to the next consolation. We can also stay in the present moment and accept that where we are is where we're supposed to be. Already covered all that. Okay, so that was rule 11, living the balanced life. As I said, I think it's my favorite rule. Just so practical and awesome, and it has helped me live more even keel. I think the air conditioning just came on. This place is weird. It's 28 degrees outside. Okay, rule 12. Wait, another little tiny text on my screen. Here we go. I'm not going to read this rule yet. I'm going to set the stage for you for rules 12, 13, and 14. If you start reading this rule and you're a woman, it's going to make you mad. Okay? So pause for a second. Don't go there yet. And if you're a guy, you're going to be going, oh, that's not politically correct. It's not. He wrote it in the 1560s, so, you know. Let me tell you about, we shift gears again. So rules 10 and 11 sort of go together, and then 12, 13, and 14 are a shift. He's going to speak in metaphors in these three rules. You're reading the rule. Okay, so in the first 11, he speaks about consolation and desolation, focusing especially on freeing us from the bondage of desolation. Clearly, that's what we've been talking about. But in these last three rules, the language changes, and instead, Ignatius focuses on three things. In rule 12, he's going to talk about temptation. In rule 13, he's going to talk about deceits of the enemy. And in 14, he's going to describe the enemy's attacks and how he attacks. So in his discussion of desolation, Ignatius has talked about temptations. Remember, he talked about those in Rule 4 and also in Rule 7. But in Rule 12, he gets more specific, and he helps us to see that temptation is a deceptive suggestion of the enemy. Right? When you experience temptation, that sounds familiar. It's just a little suggestion. Oh, that sounds pretty good. I think I'll go look at that website. Ooh, that sounds good. I think I'll have that extra drink. Whatever it is, whatever your temptations are. Ooh, I think I'll join in this little group over here, standing around talking about, gossiping about whoever it is over there in that other office. I mean, whatever the temptation is, it's that little floating thought And you can either engage with it or you can shut it down. But there's a choice. Wait a minute, lost my place. So the temptation may, in fact, come without any affectivity. That means it may come without any feeling. It's just a lone thought. Something like, why not let prayer go until later in the day? I'm tired. I'm not going to get up and pray. Or, as I just said, why not look at that website? Sometimes the temptations have a feeling attached to them, so it could be if it's a pleasurable thing, the devil will use the past pleasure that you've experienced in doing that thing to get you to want to do it again. If anybody in here has ever been on a diet, that's the thing where you experience where you've been doing great for 4 days, and then you go to work and somebody brings in Krispy Kreme donuts and they're hot, and they just came off the line, and you're like, oh, I can't. And you smell them, and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to eat those. Okay? I'm not saying that's a sin, but that's the way it works in your brain. It's that you connect the smell, you can taste them. So that is a temptation that has an affectation with it. It has some things with it. Sometimes temptations just float through and they don't really necessarily have a feeling associated with it. Okay, so as I said before, each of these last three rules, 12, 13, and 14, employs a metaphor to illustrate the quality of the enemy's deceptive actions. So these are all three rules are about the enemy's deceptive actions in us and how they apply. So in this rule 12, what the metaphor is about, I'm going to tell you this is going to make this much less ugly to read. It's of a woman fighting with a man, and it's just a fight. That's all it is, but we'll come back to that. In rule 13, the metaphor is of a false lover, so a lover who's not really faithful. And in rule 14, the metaphor is of an astute leader of bandits. So if he's not even a good leader, he's a leader of a bunch of bad guys. Okay, so those are the three metaphors he's going to use to illustrate his point. And what he's doing is using one of these people to symbolize the enemy. So the reason women get upset is because the woman is, he's saying she's the enemy. So that's why women read this and get offended. And also it's kind of old school, the language. So the three metaphors show us the enemy's essential weakness when we respond firmly. When we respond firmly to him, whether it's to temptation, to his deceits, or his attacks, when we push back, he's a chicken. He runs away. He's a coward. He has no real power over us. All our power comes from God. The devil doesn't really have any. All he can do is tempt us and get us to fall. But it's just because we're weak that we fall. Okay, when we use the tools given to us, we can withstand temptation and sin. We can. Not 100% of the time, that's why we have the sacrament of confession, but the devil is not scary when you know how he works, and that's what Ignatius is teaching us in these last three rules. Well, really, the whole rules, but specifically these last three. The three metaphors show us the enemy's essential weakness when we respond firmly, the quality of secrecy with which the enemy seeks to hide his deceits, and that's rule 13, we'll get there in a second, and the enemy's keen sense of our weakest points. He is really good at knowing what our weakest point is and leaning into it. So if we know what our weakest point is and we figure out how to start working on that, guess what? Devil goes away. Ignatius tells us what our response should be to each of these qualities of the enemy's action. So he tells us how to handle each one of these three things. And if we're alert to these characteristics of the enemy's attacks, then we counter them more effectively with a counterattack. This is just in daily living. So in all three metaphors, Ignatius is describing the enemy and the way he acts when attacking. And the enemy's only aim is to knock you off your course, to harm you spiritually, to get you to walk away from God so that he can get you to hang out with him in hell forever. That is totally his goal, is to gather souls to hell. But that's not scary, because we have Jesus, we have the Holy Spirit, we have God the Father, we have the amazing Trinity who indwells in us, and so really, if we're paying attention, the devil can't touch us. So, what is the teaching of Rule 12? I'm going to read you this. Yeah, I have time to read it. Just so, you know, we do read it. And then I'm going to give you a different metaphor that's going to make it better. The enemy makes this a lot more palatable. The enemy acts like a woman. and being weak against vigor and strong of will. Because as it is, the way of the woman, when she is quarreling with some man to lose heart, taking flight when the man shows her much courage. And on the contrary, if the man, losing heart, begins to fly, the wrath, revenge, and ferocity of the woman is very great, and so without bounds. In the same manner, it is the way of the enemy to weaken and lose heart, his temptations taking flight, when the person who is exercising himself in spiritual things opposes a bold front against the temptations of the enemy, doing diametrically the opposite. And on the contrary, if the person who is exercising himself commences to have fear and lose heart in suffering the temptations, there is no beast so wild on the face of the earth as the enemy of human nature in following out his damnable intention with so great a malice. Okay. Instead of the woman who's the fighting with the man, and the reason Ignatius uses that metaphor is because the way men and women are supposed to interact, we're supposed to be like the Garden of Eden. We're supposed to be before the fall. We're supposed to be, the natural state is loving. Okay, so fighting is the opposite of that. Fighting, Adam and Eve didn't fight until after the fall. So all that disquiet, unloving is from the devil. And then let me get a sip of water real quick. But because this metaphor, really like for the past, for a pretty good while, longer than you would think, really since the 50s, this metaphor has not been, people don't like it. So there's lots of metaphors out there that'll work, but the one that's the simplest is the spoiled child metaphor. Okay, so think of a spoiled child. A child that's been just spoiled rotten by her parents. Okay, she gets everything she wants. And when she doesn't get what she wants, she throws a temper tantrum. And that pattern is just set up. In the same way, if all of a sudden the parents firmly respond, the child, if you do that enough times, the child is going to learn that she has to calm down and that you're not going to give in anymore. That is what the devil does. When we respond firmly to his temptations, he runs away. As I said, he's a coward. So the key point that Ignatius is trying to convey here is to be firm and stand up to the devil. So that's what he's talking about when he says, if the man losing heart begins to fly, the wrath, revenge, and ferocity of the woman is very great, and so without bounds in the same manner, it is the way of the enemy to weaken and lose heart. Okay, so the man runs away when the woman gets ferocious. So this is the devil runs away when we get ferocious with him. This should give us great hope. The enemy is a coward. Okay? Just remember that. The devil is a coward. And you got Jesus, so you're in good shape. But does that make sense? Hey, stand up to the devil. Don't give in to the temptations. You can push back. You have a lot more willpower than you think you do if you tap into leaning on God. If you lean on God and let the Holy Spirit guide you, you can do a lot more than you think you can. So, rule 13. In Rule 13, the quality of the enemy that Ignatius reveals is his desire, is the enemy's desire to remain secret and hidden. Okay, the devil does not want us talking. I'm completely surprised that I'm not sick. Usually anytime I do any talks on spiritual warfare and spiritual attack, I get sick. Or something happens. My car breaks down or whatever. Anybody will tell you that people who go out talking about spiritual warfare, the devil attacks in physical ways. I must have some really awesome. Are you praying for me, Lauren? You must be a good prayer person. I'm going to send you on my request from here on out. But the devil doesn't want us talking about him. He doesn't want us, when we're in a state of desolation, reaching out to a friend. He wants us to be, if he can cull us apart from our spiritual friends, separate us out, and get us to be in a funk all by our little selves, he wins. When we have community, when we have fellowship, we reach out to other people, God wins. Okay, so don't let, when you're in a state of desolation, don't let it fester alone. The devil is darkness, but the light will send him away. So that's why we want to bring this stuff out into the light. If we bring something into the light, the devil will run away. This is why in AA the expression is, when you think through the drink and then call your sponsor. The first thing they tell you to do is call your sponsor. Get somebody, or anybody, get somebody on the telephone. Tell them you want to have a drink. It keeps you sober. Bring it into the light. If you sit in your house looking at the bottle by yourself, guess what? It's probably not going to be a good outcome. If you get somebody on the phone, much more likely to not take the drink. Same thing applies in Rule 13. If we're tempted, we need to bring it out into the light, and the enemy will run away. All these, Matt Frad's whole ministry, his whole fight porn ministry is based on this. It's based on accountability, friendship, putting stuff on your phone, helping you bring it to the light. Having somebody to talk to about it and get rid of the shame is what helps you beat the temptation. That Matt Frad's ministry is really based on this Rule 13 of Ignatius's Discernment of Spirits. All of the enemy's work is done in the darkness. Think about sin. Most of it is things we don't want to talk about. It's embarrassing, it's shameful, I don't feel good about it. So we want to just hide. When we do that, the enemy wins. So for me, last week I was talking about how I've been sober for 32 years, but I'm an addiction switcher. And so when it's the clothes addiction, the shopping addiction kicking in, if I start sneaking bags of clothes into my house, I know I'm in trouble. I'm hiding them from wrath. If I do that, that is the devil convincing me, don't tell. First of all, I'm embarrassed that I've done it. And then I just don't want to talk about the whole situation. Yeah, but it's the hiding in the darkness. Number one clue that something's really gone wrong with me. Okay? And it still happens. So, you know, we can work on this stuff a lot, and the temptations do come back. But now I know what that is. For years I didn't know. I just compartmentalized it. But now I know. If I'm tempted to sneak something in, something's gone wrong. So I don't do that anymore. I make myself carry the bags. Past Brad, who goes, hey, what are you doing? What did you do? You know, and might be fine, but let's examine that. So accountability partners are huge. I wanted to read you, an example, because Father Gallagher describes this so well. This is coming from, this would be your interior state if you're thinking you don't want to share something. You cannot speak about this interior trouble. You can speak about anything else, but not about this. You must not speak about this. If you do, the person with whom you speak will never understand you. The person will be shocked. You could be so weak or feel such things in your heart. Will lose the esteem that he or she has for you now and will no longer wish to accompany you. The person will criticize you or laugh at you and will confirm your fears about your spiritual inadequacy. It will be unbearably painful. It is best to say nothing and do what you can yourself to carry this burden. Does that sound familiar? That is what the devil wants you to do when you're in a sinful state. Is sit with that. Okay, that's the absolute, we should do the absolute opposite. And that is what Rule 13 is telling us. So whom should we speak to in times of temptation and distress or desolation? If you have a regular confessor, even if it's somebody that you have been to Christ the King a bunch and you just had a great confession with this priest, if you're in a time where you need him, you reach out to these priests, they will absolutely respond. Email them, call them, hey, I need to make an appointment. It's pretty important. It's about a spiritual matter. They'll see you, okay? So any of these priests will see you at Christ the King. So you can always talk to a priest or a spiritual director if you have one, or if you know somebody who is a spiritual director but is not your director, but if you're in a state of crisis and you reach out and say, I just need some advice, they'll meet with you. And then alternately, you can also meet with a spiritual friend, but you need to talk to somebody who understands the battlefield and knows you. So knows you well enough that you can't trick them. So, because when we compartmentalize sin and we're in a state of denial, we're good at tricking ourselves. You need somebody that's going to hold your feet to the fire and say, hey, you're tricking yourself again. Let's be honest and talk about what's really going on. So the three people, a priest or confessor, your spiritual director or a director or a spiritual friend who knows you well. Okay, rule 14. Any questions on rule 13? Oh, I didn't even read rule 13. I'm just gonna, here, y'all read it for a sec while I drink some water. That'll get you to buy the book, so you can go back and read more about the licentious lover. Okay, rule 14. Rule 14 is about strengthening the weak point. Super helpful rule. The metaphor is of a bandit, and the devil is the bandit, conquering and robbing and taking what he wants by attacking us at our weakest point. So in the same way that as a gang of bandits is surrounding a fortress and figuring out how they're going to break in, they're going to circle around it and figure out what are the strengths of the fortress, what are the weaknesses, how can we get in, what's going to be stupid, what's the best way to approach this. That's what the devil's doing. So he's looking. So I always use myself as an example because I won't get in trouble talking about myself. I don't want to reveal things about my directees or my family. I don't have to, you know, I could change names, whatever. But I can always, you know, I'm an open book. And I always have been, so it's just easy to throw myself under the bus. When the devil looks at me, he would be thinking, okay, so, gosh, he hasn't had a drink in 32 years. That's probably really not going to work. I'm not going to tempt her with alcohol anymore because she seems to be doing okay on that. And, you know, gosh, she's been praying daily now for about a year. And so I don't really think that's not really working anymore either. Gosh, I really used to be able to get her there. I used to be able to convince her that, God, this was stupid and she didn't have time to pray. And she wasn't really getting anything out of the prayer. And why do that? And gosh, she's even going to some daily masses now. And I used to be able to tell her that she didn't have time to do that. And in fact, gosh, when she worked here, she didn't even go to daily mass. But now she does. So I can't really do that. I mean, that really worked for a long time, but that's not working. Let me think. Oh, I'll tell you what I can do. While she's working on her computer, there's going to be some ads that pop up. Now, I recognize that this is the way the ad industry works, because Joaquin told me this last week, and it's all computer programming, but the temptation is there for me. So where the devil has figured out that he can work is to tempt me with this stupid shopping addiction, which I'm just so sick of. Oh my gosh, there's a new cute pair of pants. Oh my gosh, look at those shoes. Oh my gosh, there's a new pillow from our house. Oh, I need new Christmas decorations. Y'all, I don't need anything. I have just, no. But he tempts me with it. And periodically, that one I will still play. I will still give in to that one. And it's not like that's my only son. Judgmentalism, pride, you know, I mean, there's a lot of them. But that one is particularly effective for him. And so what I've been doing is trying to establish very concrete boundaries for myself on what I will and won't do. You know, I told y'all that my spiritual director has told me things like, you've got to learn to live in the middle, because I like to do things very black and white. So like, okay, I'm not going to buy anything for 2 months. Well, that's great, but then I'm not actually facing temptation. I'm just saying I'm not going to do it. So you've got to learn how to handle the temptation. So, you know, I have to see things I want and go, okay, I don't need that. What am I doing? I'm just doing it because I'm bored. No, I'm not going to play. So that's where knowing the trap. And I know, you can hear what I just said to you. I've begun to figure out how the devil sees me. And that's because I'm very aware of my own sin. You want to become aware of your sin so that you know yourself, but not so, you never want to but think you're unlovable. And if you struggle with scrupulosity, where you think you're a really bad sinner and you're really not, if anybody in this room thinks they struggle with scrupulosity, come talk to me after. I'll give you some things to read. It's a tough deal. But people who are scrupulous think they're in a state of mortal sin all the time, and they're usually not. They're like doing nothing bad. Tends to be more women than men. People that are perfectionists, people that struggle with anxiety, they're always trying to be perfect and hit the mark. And so they get confused and think they can earn their way to heaven. And so they also then become very aware of their sin, and they freak out and think that they're horrible people when they're usually some of the holiest people. It's very interesting. So scrupulosity is a big trick the devil can play on people. Anyway, if any of those patterns sound familiar, come talk to me after. I'll give you a bunch of, send you some links to read, and that will help. And you really do need a spiritual director if you struggle with scrupulosity. Anyway, the more you begin to understand your sin patterns, how your mind works, and what works for the positive. I now know how to get myself up and pray every day, how to go to Mass on a regular basis. Like, these are just habits. A lot of it's just habituation. But you become familiar with how to live in a way that's close to God. And once you hit that stride, it's not that hard to stay there. You kind of get a rhythm. You get surrounded by people that are living the same way. It works. You just have to be constant. Just, it's so much like an exercise plan. Being a Christian is so much like training to be an athlete. So similar. One really helpful tip on learning your weakest point is found in a great book called, I've mentioned it the first week, it's called Navigating the Interior Life. It's written by Dan Burke. You can get it on Amazon. And in it, there's a chapter called Learning Your Root, Understanding Your Root Sin, identifying your root sin. A root sin is the place that you most often sin. So, just for general purposes, and this has been really for about 800 years, the church has categorized, if you're looking at root sins, there are three. Usually you will suffer from one of these more than the other: vanity, sensuality, or pride. Yes, there are the seven deadly sins, but you really can kind of distill them down to those three. So in this book, Dan Burke's book, Navigating the Interior Life, there is one of those chart quizzes, and you do it prayerfully, and you figure out what your root sin is. When you know your root sin, you will look back over your life and go, oh my gosh, look how the devil has been tempting me with that. I thought for sure mine was going to be vanity. I thought for sure, very vain. I took that test, and it was sensuality, which, duh, I'm an alcoholic. Of course it's sensuality. So if sensuality is your root sin, you like pleasure, and you like to escape. When I look back at my life, that's all I do. It's ridiculous. But I had no idea until I did this test. I was like, oh my gosh. So now I know where the devil's going to hit me. He's going to try to distract me with temptations that are about pleasure. Okay, that is a huge tool to have to work against him, to keep him at bay. So I discovered this at age 54. I'm hoping that you guys will get this in your 20s and 30s. You get this now, your life is going to look radically different. I wish I had known this 20 years ago. It's just, at least I learned it finally. But anyway, so navigating the interior life, identifying your root sin, huge help. The light bulb will go off. Now, when you take it, if you're tied between two, retake it and see if one doesn't pop out to you more. And in this book, Dan describes how to do this. He walks you through it step by step, so I'm not going to tell you that. But it's a great book. Highly recommend Navigating the Interior Life. So once we know which sin dominates us, we can begin to work on the opposite virtue and also the pitfalls of that sin. So the opposite virtue of sensuality is temperance and fortitude. So guess what I need to do? I need to learn to deny myself. I need to do mortifications. I need to not please Helen. Okay, so now I have a game plan. I can work on that. That means I'm not just worrying about not doing the sin. I'm actually working towards the positive. So when we're working on overcoming a sin, we want to work to the opposite virtue. And when you work towards a virtue, you always kind of land in the middle. But you always want to head toward that virtue if you can. So that finding your root sin is a very powerful tool. Rule 14 is really just a further clarification of Rule 10. It tells us where to begin to make preparations, which is at our weakest point. So Rules 10 and 14 are about preparing. Make sense? Okay. What to do after tonight? Definitely get the book or listen to the podcast. I can't say that enough. Because if you just are like, yeah, that sounds cool, I'll start doing it, but you don't do either one of those two, don't read the book or listen to the podcast, you're not going to really get it into your head. When you read it or listen on your own, you make it yours. Then number two, pay attention, start paying attention. Hopefully those of you that have been the past couple weeks have been doing that. You've been starting to pay attention to what's happening inside. The more you do it, the easier it gets. And then number three, pray the examine prayer at night and journal your insights. I put on this front table, there's three handouts, same ones from last week. Prayer of the present moment. There's the litany of trust. There's a walk through the examination of the examine prayer. So if you want to know how to do that, it's on this front table. And then also, I hand out a Lectio Divina, which is the best way to pray daily. You can do that in about 10 or 15, 20 minutes in the mornings, praying with the Gospels. It walks you through how to do it on that sheet. If you don't pray daily, by all means, start. And I don't mean just like casually talking to God is awesome. Praying the rosary is awesome. We should do something related to Mary every day. But having prayer time alone with God between 10 and 20 minutes a day is the only way to grow in holiness. You got to go to Mass and confession too, but without daily prayer, you're not really going to go anywhere. So praying the examine at night is where you're looking back over your day, and the instructions for it are on the table up here. Here's what it looks like. Oh, here's the examine. Let me tell you about this journal. Lauren sent me this last week. Did you send it out to any of these guys or no?
No.
Okay, so Jennifer Lewis, who used to be, y'all probably all know her, she used to be head of 20s, 30s, and now she works at Christ the King, communication director. She found this book that's called The Examine Journal. It's on Amazon. There is also a really pretty flowery version, but I picked the more neutral one so everyone would want it. But if you want a flowery one, it's on there. It's the same book. So it's called The Examine Journal. It's on Amazon. I grabbed this picture from Amazon. You can see the description there from Amazon. Following the format of the Examine Prayer developed by St. Ignatius, the Examine Journal is a prayer tool to empower you to reflect on your daily highs and lows as a means of exploring God's presence in your life. Meaningful questions guide your journal entries. If you want to pray the Examine Prayer, get this thing. I checked it out. I looked at it. It looks amazing. I think it will really be a great tool if you've liked everything we've talked about the last 3 weeks. It looks absolutely amazing. It'll just guide you through it. It's like having your own spiritual director in a book. Same with navigating the interior life. If you're looking for a director and you can't find one, get that book. It will get you started. Here's what the examine looks like. The movements, or the things you're praying through is you're giving thanks to God, you're asking for the Holy Spirit's guidance, you're reviewing your day, you're looking for the grace that was within your day, and then you're making a resolution, if there is any, from what you see over the day. Obviously, that is a ridiculously short summary of the examine prayer, and there's a much longer explanation that's very well done by a guy named Jared Deese, and it's on the table up here. So, pray the examine if you're interested in the discernment of spirits, because you kind of can't do it without the examine. Make a battle plan for desolation. Go ahead and do that so that when you experience it, you know what you're going to do. If it's a temptation, make a plan on how you're going to resist some temptation, even if it's just like call a friend or put blocks on your phone, put blocks on your computer, whatever it is for you. Don't drive by the Chick-fil-A if that's, whatever. Just come up with concrete things to help you fight temptation. Or if the desolation is more of really a serious desolation where you're in a funk and you feel kind of crippled and you can't get off the couch, come up with a battle plan. Okay, this is one I developed for, I mentioned this last week, for when I freak out and worry about my kids. So I do, this is, you see how many of it's pray. I pray the St. Michael prayer, I pray the Hail Mary, and I ask her to wrap me in her mantle of protection. I call a spiritual friend, I pray the prayer of the present moment, which is on the table up here, and then I pray the litany of trust. By the time I've done that, I'm back on course, and I have fought off the desolation. Okay, so come up with your own plan before you're in desolation. Then you'll have it. I have this on my phone, a nice little short version with all the prayers listed. So if I'm out and about and this hits, I can read it. And then that's the prayer of the present moment, which is just a beautiful prayer. So, questions, comments? Has this been helpful? I've never taught this before. I think I told you all that the first night. You were the guinea pigs. So I hope it has not been too confusing. It really needs 4 to 6 weeks, so teaching it in 3 is tight. It's definitely tight. But if I've piqued your interest, if something in here has resonated, then that's a win. As I said, dig into it, learn it, you know, make it your own, and then you can use it and the pieces that make sense to you. If you really love this stuff and you want to be led through the Ignatian exercises, I recommend a parishioner here whose name is John Monroe. He led me through the exercises. Phenomenal, life-changing, took 10 months. But I'm slow, so maybe it could be done in 8. And you know, I talk lots of hard times, took a long time, our sessions. But anyway, he's a parishioner here. I think his contact info is at the front desk. So if you're like, oh my gosh, I love this, I want to do the Ignatian exercises, go to the front desk, ask for John's contact info, email him, say Helen sent me, and I'll shoot him a text and tell him. I told a room of a bunch of people that they could reach out to you. So he's a spiritual director. If you're a guy and you need a spiritual director, I recommend him. Oops, he's going to have a lot of people. He's great. Yes? Pearl.
Yes, my
I remember you from one.
I have a problem with that guy calling vanity a sin rather than a perfection. Then it seems like you're going to be screwed by passing it. I don't feel like those are really sins. I feel like the more psychological problems, maybe there's a root cause for vanity or.
No, because there, all right, so vanity is thinking, here's the way to think about the 3 root sins. Vanity is I care more about everybody else's opinion of me than God. So I put other people's opinion before God. God always has to come first. So vanity, sensuality, and pride are the 3 ways we put other things before God. So vanity is other people's opinion first. Pride is I put me first. I have it all figured out. I can solve every problem. I know all the answers. I got it right. Okay, so that's me first. So other people, vanity is other people's opinion first. Pride is putting myself first before God. And then sensuality is putting pleasure in things before God. So they're all just, what do I put before God? So that's why they're sins. Anything we put before God is a sin. It's not an imperfection, it's a sin.
Well,
I mean, it could be an imperfection.
Let's take vanity for example. Let's say someone cares about other people's opinions. You see them in the bucket all the time. You go and help direct them to
tea. Right. Yeah.
But there was a root cause. They were using their upbringing.
Yeah, absolutely. Your root sin comes from a root cause. Right. So it doesn't make it not a sin, but what you want to do, and this is where Dan walks through this in this book, is you've got to figure out what your root sin is about. What is the root wound that causes the root sin? So you look back at your life and you figure out, usually it's in the first 7 years the root sin forms. It's probably a language thing. I mean, what since the fall, because of concupiscence, we all tend to put ourselves before God. And how that manifests is what the root sin is describing. Does that make sense?
I do agree with you that we all tend to put ourselves.
Right. And so this is a way to describe how we would put our root sin first. I mean, how we would put ourselves first. The root sin describes what is the primary way that I don't think about God first, before myself. Oops, yes?
Helen, thank you. It's been very informative.
Oh, you're welcome.
Even though it's compressed.
It's very compressed.
But yeah, it's been good. From all of your studies, I guess the have you ever come across any discussion about like the times of the day? Like there can be certain times, like some people, you know, like they experience burglaries in the morning, like the morning may be the time that they're tempted. For people who have issues with pornography, it could be in the evening. Is there any kind of discussion about the time of the day and how to be prepared to kind of put up a defense against these things?
I have not read anything about that. I bet there's something out there somewhere. Would be worth checking into. That would be interesting. I haven't come across it, but and that's again, I think a thing where you want to get to know yourself and know what happens in your day. You know, when the time that you're most tempted, or when is the time that's, you know, a great thing to figure out is when is your prayer the most fruitful. So to know both sides of it, when are things most likely to be good? When are things most likely to be tough? Because I think when you generalize too much, then it's not. I mean, the discernment of spirits is all about personalization. It's so much about you figuring out yourself so that you can withstand the attacks of the devil. That's what's so cool about it, is it looks different for every single person in this room. It looks different for how the rules work in your life. Are different depending on how you grew up, you know, what your walk is like, all these, you know, your personality, your temper. I mean, just lots of different ways that it plays out. That makes sense? Any other questions? Okay, I'll hang out after, if anybody wants to come ask me a question that you don't want to ask in front of all these people. Let's stand and close with, do y'all know the St. Michael prayer?
Yes.
We'll praise